Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, August 29th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. Let's start off today with the article, "The Sky is Absolutely Not Falling. Waterloo Police Chief Responds to Letter Questioning Morale." Waterloo's police chief says retention and recruiting issues at the Waterloo Police Department are a part of a larger problem nationwide. The sky is absolutely not falling in the Waterloo Police Department. This community can rest assured that each employee at the WPD, tenured and new, will continue to be held to the high standards and established over the past year, and we will continue to provide the high-performance, innovative, and community-inclusive law enforcement service that all persons deserve and expect, Chief Joel Fitzgerald said Thursday. Fitzgerald's comments were in response to a joint letter signed by three former Waterloo police chiefs warning about flagging morale at the department. "The current physical work environment at the police department is a disgrace. More and more officers are leaving the department each month," the letter states. "The police department is currently down 7 officers." Fitzgerald said that the issue isn't unique to Waterloo Police Department. "It is easily verifiable that a vast majority of agencies struggle to recruit and retain officers, but many lack the support of leadership or a history of supportive government that allows their agencies to better equipped to actively hire and recruit new police officers. Some jurisdictions have even reduced the number of officers serving in their communities, but that has not been the case in Waterloo," the chief said. Fitzgerald said politicizing the issue is divisive, purposeful, and irresponsible. "My experience as a police chief has taught me that there are persons who serve in law enforcement in the past who unfairly lob criticism when they lack the introspective capacity to unpack many of the problems that we experience in this industry that were created by those who lack the vision, effectiveness, or courage to challenge the status quo," Fitzgerald said. The Waterloo Police Department is currently taking applications, and there's information and an online way to submit applications on a web portal. Now let's move on to Maple Lane's Bowling Center rolls back bigger and better than before. On Friday morning, leagues and recreational bowlers were already rolling on the lanes at the newly rebuilt Maple Lane's Bowling Center at 2608 University Avenue. The co-owners Rich and Kathy Egeem were busy finishing last-minute details in the Kingpin Social. They expect the new bar and restaurant to tentatively open around Labor Day. They are hesitant to give a firm date because some items for the area are still in transit. More than a year ago, contractors began rebuilding the iconic 62-year-old bowling center that was nearly destroyed by an arsonist in the early morning hours of February 4th, 2020. "Building back, I decided to think outside the box," said Rich. "I've been in the bowling business around about 35 years, and I've traveled and visited to a lot of other bowling centers. What you see now, what has been created, is the culmination of ideas from all the bowling centers I have seen and wanted to have here." Maple Lanes has reopened as an entertainment center with many more activities in addition to bowling. There are 28 glossy new lanes and masking units sporting a collection of black and white image with pops of color featuring recognizable historic local entities, including Waterloo's Electric Park Bowling, Starlight Theater, and Riverfront Stadium. A new lighting system allows each lane to have its own color show, as well as opportunities for bona fide light shows and a new sound system for rock and bowl, Rich said. The front desk is now in the center of the bowling alley next to the laneside bar and grill. The pro shop has been moved from the west side to the opposite side of the building, and the bathrooms are in a new location. About 20 feet was added to the west side of the building for the new restaurant, bar, and mezzanine. Bowling and dinner, or simply a good meal, is on the menu at Kingpin Social. The restaurant and bar can be entered through the bowling center or a separate entrance angled towards University Avenue. "In designing the space, we had the thought that this would be a great place for a company to have a team building event, meet, eat, socialize, and maybe bowl, and go have some fun. A place where people who aren't interested in bowling could come and enjoy the food," said Kathy. "A quartz bar, poured concrete epoxy flooring, and a variety of seating, including booths, create a welcoming space. Hanging above the bar is a trio of vintage 1950s pin setters. On tap will be a selection of local and regional craft beers. Mixed drinks and other beverages will be available, as well as adult milkshakes concocted from vanilla bean ice cream, rum, or other liquor and flavorings. At the entrance to the restaurant stands a classic 1950s Tele-E store scoring table in lieu of a hostess stand. We're jumping off a cliff here, opening a restaurant. We've hired a chef, Kevin Klein, who is developing a menu that has bowling alley staples, but is also a broader and more adventurous with upscale renditions of American classics, Rich said. Monte Cristo sandwiches, brat corn dogs, smoked brisket, mac and cheese bakes, and other dishes are planned. Klein has also created Inferno, a collection of smoked meats including baby back ribs, hush puppies, and other bites served with a flame at the tableside. On the bar's main level are four duckpin lanes. Duckpin, similar to a standard 10-pin bowling and popular in the northeastern U.S., is enjoying a renaissance around the country. The novelty bowling game uses five 5-pound, 5-inch ball without finger holes and requires a different skill set than regular bowling. It levels the field between experienced and inexperienced bowlers. Equipment for the custom-built duckpin lanes are concealed behind classic and hard-to-find Brunswick gold crown masking units constructed from metal and stretched canvas. We didn't want to go retro with the entire bowling center, but we wanted nuances of bowling history. It's a big part of who we are, Rich said. Upstairs, there will be a billiards table, darts, pinball, and other games and activities. In colder months, Rich expects to start a few indoor bag leagues, because the mezzanine ceiling is high enough that we can do that. Outdoor seasonal offerings will include two sand volleyball courts for league play, a beer garden, fire pit, and seating. Both Rich and Kathy are happy about realizing their dream of what a bowling center can offer in the Cedar Valley. The bowling community was supportive and there for us, especially on those days you wondered why you were doing it, and you thought about quitting, Kathy noted. Rich added, "It's bittersweet because of how it happened with the fire, but we're back with a new and improved bowling center." Now on to the article, Iowa tops 1,000 new COVID infections per day as nursing home outbreaks rise. Three more nursing home outbreaks of COVID-19 have been reported in Iowa in recent days, including one in Cedar Falls, bringing the total number of care facility outbreaks to 8. That coincides with the recent rapid growth in the community spread of COVID-19 in Iowa. According to the New York Times, there were 2,560 newly reported cases of COVID-19 throughout Iowa on Wednesday, the highest single-day tally since December 11th. The weekly average of new infections reported each day in Iowa now stands at 1,016, more than three times the average of 319 reported on July 29th. Hospitalizations in Iowa are up 35% over the past 2 weeks, and the overall rate of infections is up 46%, according to the Times. The Newton Healthcare Center in Jasper County posted a note to its Facebook page last week, indicating that, as of August 22nd, it had four residents and one staff member who had tested positive for COVID-19. The Iowa Department of Public Health did not disclose that outbreak in a list of all nursing homes outbreaks that it gave the Iowa Capital Dispatch on August 25th. The department's list also omitted a new outbreak at the state-run Iowa Veterans Home, the sixth COVID-19 outbreak at the facility since its beginning of the pandemic. The agency has said that the list was compiled days earlier and represented only a snapshot of confirmed cases at that point in time. A department spokesman confirmed the Newton outbreak late Thursday, but did not respond when asked about other previously unreported outbreaks in Iowa care facilities. On Thursday, IDPH was reporting on its website that there were 8 nursing homes in Iowa with active outbreaks. Because the department is no longer reporting the size or the location or size of such outbreaks, the names of the facilities are uncertain. However, IDPH identified through a public records request 5 Iowa nursing homes that last week were in an outbreak status with at least 3 infections among staff and or residents. Assuming those 5, the Newton facility and the Veterans Home outbreaks are still active, 7 of the 8 sites referenced by IDPH on their website can be identified. Those sites are Kingsley Specialty Care in Plymouth County, where 8 residents and or workers are infected, Pinnacle Specialty Care in Cedar Falls, where 5 residents and or workers are infected, Hubbard Care Center in Hardin County, where 6 residents and or workers are infected, Montrose Health Center in Lee County, where 14 residents and or workers are infected, West Ridge Specialty Care in Marion County, where 15 residents and our workers are infected. The Iowa Veterans Home in Marshall County, where the home's clinical support director has reportedly informed the families of 3 infections among the residents and 5 infections among staff. And the Newton Healthcare Center in Jasper County, where 5 residents and or staff members were infected. Now let's move on to a different article. Waterloo police make second arrest in fatal shooting. A second person has been arrested in what the police said was an apparent robbery that led to gunfire and the death of a Waterloo man on Tuesday. On Thursday night, Waterloo police arrested Dejon Gerald Stokes, 28, of Waterloo, on a charge of first-degree robbery. Bond was set at $100,000. Officers had earlier arrested 17-year-old Alvani Jante Stone for robbery and intimidation with a weapon. He is charged as an adult, and his bond is set at $200,000. Police were called to a report of gunfire in front of the Quick Stop 3 convenience store on Washington Street, U.S. Highway 218, around 4:39 p.m. Officers found a 20-year-old Dayton L. Sanders of Waterloo dead in a grassy highway median. Investigators allege Stokes and Stone climbed into a vehicle parked at the store and assaulted the driver. Gunfire broke out when the driver attempted to flee, and Stone was seen shooting, according to the records. Sanders walked to the median and collapsed. Investigators were able to identify Stokes and Stone from the clothing that they were wearing, seen in surveillance videos, court records state. Police allege Stokes had been talking earlier in the day about robbing someone in a red car. Authorities are asking the public to submit any photos or videos they might have in connection with the shooting. Videos can be submitted through an online portal, and there is a long link that is waterloopdia.evidence.com/axon/citizen/public/Washington Street shooting. Anyone with information is asked to contact Waterloo Police at 319-291-4340 and option 3 investigations. Now on to the article. At Hinson campaign kickoff, GOP rips Democrats for attempts to transform America. The road to the majority runs through Iowa, and the combination of Democrats' radical left agenda and presidential incompetence is paving the way for a Republican takeover of Congress, according to the slate of Republican speakers at a kickoff rally for Representative Ashley Hinson's re-election. There is a tidal wave building, Texas Senator Ted Cruz told the crowd of nearly 700 people Saturday at the Linn County Fairgrounds. He said people are not happy with Democrats who shut down small businesses, close schools, and are trying to silence and take away the freedoms of millions of Americans. "We're getting pissed off," the winner of Iowa's 2016 First in Nation caucuses said. "These tinpot socialists tick off the American people at their peril." Darren Whiting of Marion agreed it's likely conservatives will win control of the House next year because, as I listen to people, they're fed up with what's going on, and Democrats aren't making it very easy for a big win in 2022. After a moment of silence for the Marines killed in Afghanistan, Hinson welcomed a star-studded lineup that included Cruz and Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, as well as Senator Chuck Grassley, Governor Kim Reynolds, and Representatives Marionette Miller-Meeks and Randy Fenstra. America's longest-serving governor, former Iowa Governor Terry Branstad, was on hand, too. "Fortunately, for Iowa's 1st District," Cruz said, "Hinson wakes up every day in Washington, straps on her gladiator armor, and goes to battle the lunatics. She was not without her distractors at the Central City Fairgrounds. Standing in front of a mobile billboard, speakers with Progress Iowa called out Hinson for opposing the American Rescue Plan and expanded health care. Representative Hinson had a historic opportunity to deliver for the people of Iowa back in March by voting in favor of the American Rescue Plan, but she instead wholeheartedly opposed this landmark piece of legislation," said Stacy Walker, a Linn County supervisor. "When you're elected to Congress, you're expected to fight for the people you represent," added Laura Packard, executive director of Healthcare Voter, These issues are too important to ignore. Representative Hinson needs to stop saying no to Iowans' health care. Hinson's barbecue bash was, according to many longtime Republicans in the crowd, the largest off-year campaign event they can recall for an Iowa U.S. House member. It wasn't lost on the freshman representative, who will face a challenge from Democratic State Senator Liz Mathis. Senator Cruz hit the nail on the head. People are ticked off, Hinson said. Clearly, what's going on in people's minds is they think that this country is going in the wrong direction, and they are ready to engage. They're here today to support me because they know it's time to speak up, and they know that they have a representative who will continue to speak up. The death of American servicemen and women in Kabul is only the latest debacle of President Joe Biden and congressional Democrats, Hinson said. She criticized the president for poor planning of the Afghanistan withdrawal. Miller Meeks, who served 24 years in the Army, took it up a notch, calling Afghanistan Biden's Saigon. She has called on Biden to resign. The Marines did not deserve to be betrayed by their president, said Miller Meeks, prompting calls of traitor and try him for treason. Hinson set a tone for the afternoon, framing the 2022 election as being about the future of the country. We all know what's at stake in this election, she said. It is truly the future of this country. It's why you sent me to Washington to work for you, to be your voice. Before the coronavirus pandemic, she said, America's economy was strong. The Republican formula to lower taxes, less regulation, and letting people do what they do best was working. We've seen President Biden and Nancy Pelosi take this country in the wrong direction, Hinson said. We've put our safety and security at risk, both here and at home, overseas. There's also a crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border, she said, as more than 1 million illegal immigrants have crossed into the United States this year. We need to build the wall, she said, which drew enthusiastic response from the crowd, many wearing Trump shirts and caps. We love President Trump, don't we, Hinson said, adding that she has been advocating for Trump's policies that worked. Democrats came to town to transform America, said Grassley, who is expected to announce his re-election campaign in November. And Ashley and I, on the other Republicans, are there to preserve America. I think you have to realize that this is a real transformation if they get their program. It won't be the America we've had for 240 years. Democrats don't love the America we love, McDaniel added. When Republicans talk to their friends and neighbors about that love of country, that they can change votes, she said. When we have those conversations, we can make a difference, McDaniel said. You are the backbone of our party. In a midterm election when fewer people turn out, you will be the difference between whether or not we retire Nancy Pelosi. Now on to a different article. How much impact could Sturgis rally have on COVID caseload? Rumbles from the motorcycles and rock shows of the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally have hardly cleared from the Black Hills of South Dakota, and the reports of COVID-19 infections among rallygoers are already streaming in. 178 cases across 5 states, according to the contact tracers. In the 3 weeks since the rally kicked off, coronavirus cases in South Dakota have shot up at a startling pace, sixfold from the early days of August. While it is not clear how much rallygoers spread the virus through secondary infections, state health officials so far have reported 63 cases among South Dakota residents who attended the event. The epicenter of the rally, Meade County, has become red-hot with new cases, reaching a per capita rate that is similar to the hardest-hit southern states. The country reported the highest rate of cases in the state over the last 2 weeks, according to Johns Hopkins researchers. The Black Hills region largest hospital system, Monument Health, warned Friday that it has seen hospitalizations of the virus rise from 5 to 78 this month. The hospital was bracing for more COVID-19 patients by converting rooms to intensive care units and resigning staff. Virus cases were already on the rise when the rally started. It's difficult to measure just how much the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally is to blame in a region where local fairs, youth sports and leagues, and other gatherings have resumed. However, Meade County could be a harbinger of things to come for the upper Midwest as infections ripple from those events, said Dr. Michael Osterholm, director of the University of Minnesota's Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. This coronavirus forest fire will keep burning any human wood it can find, he said. It will find you, and it is so infectious. Health officials in North Dakota, Wyoming, Minnesota, and Wisconsin all reported cases among people who attended the rally, with North Dakota also reporting 2 hospitalizations. Some health officials noted people could have caught the virus elsewhere. A team from the Center of Disease Control and Prevention determined last year's rally looked like a super-spreader event. The team said the event offered a lesson. Such large gatherings can result in widespread transmission of infections, and attendees should follow precautions like getting vaccinated, wearing masks, and social distancing. The aftermath of this year's rally looked eerily similar to last year, when the event heralded a wave that did not subside until the winter. But the pandemic fallout from the rally won't be seen for weeks, and an exact caseload will likely remain unknown, Osterholm said. Daniel Buscelli, a spokesman for the State Department of Health, said the virus spike is following a national trend of being experienced in every state, not just South Dakota. He also pointed out that Meade County's vaccination rate at 45% lags behind the statewide rate of 56% eligible people vaccinated. The city of Strugus also downplayed the virus numbers, issuing a statement that blamed the increase in positivity rate on a significant increase in testing performed to proactively reduce the spread of COVID-19 and accusing individuals in the national media of mischaracterizing the event. Despite the more contagious Delta variant, this year's motorcycle rally was even bigger than last year. More than 500,000 people showed up during the 10-day rally. The streets of Sturgis filled up with rallygoers drawn to the libertarian rules of South Dakota. Motorcycle helmets weren't required, minimal attire and body painting were welcome, and masks were often nowhere in sight. Bikers bellied up to bars and packed into rock shows. 2 bands that performed at the rally have canceled shows after musicians came down with the virus. Corey Taylor, the lead singer of Slipknot, who had embarked on a solo tour, told fans that he was very, very sick from COVID-19, though he did not say where he contracted it. "This is the worst I've ever been sick in my life," Taylor said in a Facebook video this week. "Had I not been vaccinated, I shudder to think how bad it would have been." Now let's go on to deadly rural crashes prompt safety efforts. Sarah Risser never imagined that a drive to go cross-country skiing on a cold January morning in 2019 would change her life forever. Her 18-year-old son, Henry Zitlow, had returned home to Minnesota for a winter break after his first semester at college. Zitlow was behind the wheel of their Subaru Forester, driving his mom on a rural 2-lane Wisconsin road. Suddenly, a pickup truck driver towing a flatbed trailer in the opposite direction lost control, crossed the centerline, and hit their car head-on. The Subaru spun into a ditch, striking a tree. Zitlow, who was trapped in the car, suffered severe head trauma. He died at the scene. "It's been absolutely devastating to our family," said Risser, 54, of Minneapolis. "We're going to grieve for the rest of our lives." Zitlow, a violinist and member of the varsity rowing team at Bowdoin College in Maine, was one of more than 16,000 people who died in a car crash on U.S. rural roads in 2019. His mother and many transportation experts and highway safety advocates say those roads need to be made safer. Some federal and state officials are taking note. The $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill passed by the U.S. Senate touched on the problem. It would require a study of the issue and launch a new rural road giant program that includes $300 million for high-risk rural road safety programs. And safety analysis should be a part of many individual projects funded by the package, advocates say. States are tackling some work independently. In Illinois, after pressure from a lawmaker, the state's transportation agency agreed to survey and prioritize the most dangerous rural intersections. Kansas, Minnesota, and South Carolina are spending significant amounts to upgrade safety infrastructure or come up with ways to prevent rural crashes. Relatively simple engineering changes, such as rumble strips, median barriers, and pavement markings, better lighting, and wider shoulders can make a big difference in rural road safety, transportation experts and advocates say. We can educate and enforce until the cows come home. That's only going to go so far. If the underlying systems aren't designed with safety in mind, said Leah Schaumhum, director of Vision Zero Network, an Oakland, California-based national advocacy group that promotes the goal of zero traffic deaths or severe injuries for road ushers. Every small or mid-sized rural community doesn't need to recreate the wheel, Shaum said. We need more leadership from the state and federal level to say, here are the best practices for safety, and here's funding to implement them. But Shaum said federal, state, and local governments aren't using road funding in a safety-first way. Too often, we've seen transportation money be this political grab bag, and it's not focused on the safety priorities, she said. There should be standards and accountability for improving safety without that funding. The Senate's package's rural road safety language was based on a bill filed in May by U.S. Senator Mark Kelly, an Arizona Democrat, and Richard Burr, a North Carolina Republican, that would have provided $750 million for safety projects on high-risk rural roads. In the House, lawmakers filed a similar bipartisan bill in April that would create a $600 million competitive grant program that local governments could apply for to make infrastructure safety improvements on rural roads. Crashes in urban areas often get more attention, and they increasingly involve pedestrians and bicyclists. But nearly half of the more than 36,000 traffic fatalities in the United States each year occur on rural roads, even though only about a fifth of the population lives in rural areas, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. In 2019, the fatality rate on rural roads was nearly twice as high on urban ones, according to the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, a nonprofit research group funded by auto insurance companies. Transportation experts say a combination of higher speeds, narrow shoulders, lack of lighting, and lots of curves contribute to the problem. So does the fact that emergency responders might be some distance away and can take longer to arrive at the scene and transport injured drivers and passengers to hospitals. Hillary Inselbrands, a senior safety engineer at the Federal Highway Administration, said her agency takes a proactive approach to safety when working with state transportation and departments by using data to figure out in advance of construction and maintenance what kinds of changes they can make to prevent serious crashes. The idea is to anticipate human error by road users, then redesign or add safety features to reduce or eliminate risks. The agency also provides technical assistance to local agencies facing rural road safety challenges. As engineers, we're not going to solve these issues by ourselves. Law enforcement isn't either, and it's the same for EMS, she said. We can't do it by ourselves, but if we all come together and combine it with education, we might be able to get to zero deaths. 9 out of 10 rural traffic fatalities occur on two-lane roads, according to a May 2020 report by TRIP, a national nonprofit transportation research center. The combination of rumble strips and wider shoulders can help prevent some of the worst crashes, said Robert Wunderlich, director of the Center for Transportation Safety at the Texas A&M Transportation Institute. Rumble strips alert you when you've made an error, he said. The shoulder gives you a place to recover. Risser, whose son was killed in Wisconsin, said the rumble strips or a median might have prevented the crash. It's extremely important that people who are in positions of authority and leadership start addressing this issue, Risser said. Now let's go on to the article, Pride Fest Returns to the Cedar Valley. The Cedar Valley's annual celebration of inclusion and diversity returned this weekend after a one-year hiatus. The two-year Cedar Valley Pride Fest entertained thousands who came to downtown Waterloo to show their support for the LGBTQ community. About a dozen musical artists graced the main stage on 4th Street, with One Up Duo headlining Friday and Toxic by Garrick on Saturday. Vendors along the streets offered a variety of LGBTQ attire, selling rainbow-colored clothing and accessories. Many attendees could be seen wearing gay pride or gender-specific flags draped over their shoulders like capes. Drag artists jumped on the stage throughout the weekend, dancing and receiving tips from adoring fans. Many local businesses set up tents to offer information on health care and churches. The educational series held in Speaker's Alley offered sessions on homosexuality and the Bible, public health, and an update on LGBTQ legislative issues. And now let's go on to Governor Reynolds issues disaster proclamation for Bremer County. Governor Kim Reynolds issued a disaster proclamation today for Bremer County in response to severe weather that began Tuesday. The governor's proclamation allows state resources to be utilized to recover and activity and activates the Iowa Individual Assistance Grant Program for qualifying residents. The Iowa Individual Assistance Grant Program provides up to $5,000 for households with income up to 200% of the federal poverty level for a family of three. Grants are available for home and car or car repairs, replacement of clothing or food, and temporary housing expenses. Original receipts are required for those seeking reimbursement for actual expenses related to storm recovery. The grant application and instructions are available on the Iowa Department of Human Health Services website. Potential applicants have 45 days from the date of the proclamation to submit a claim. Residents are asked to report damage to property, roads, and utilities. May be reported at www.homelandsecurity.iowa.gov. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, August 29th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Edward Ed Kemp. A memorial celebration of life for Edward Ed Kemp will take place on Sunday, September 5th from 1 to 4, hosted by the Cedar Falls AMVET Post 49. He passed away on November 11th, 2020 from COVID. Ed was born in Waterloo, Iowa on November 27th, 1943 to Joseph and Sue Quinn Kemp. He graduated from Immaculate Conception High School in Fairbank, Iowa in 1962. Following this, Ed enlisted in the United States Air Force, where he served until 1966. While serving in the Shreveport, Louisiana, he met Evelyn Krutoff, and they were married in 1965. Four children were born to them, and they eventually divorced. After their service, Ed went to work at John Deere, where he became a plumber and heat vent specialist. This training was a result of his GI benefits from the military. He worked there until his retirement in 1999. The AMVETS became a very important part of Ed's life. During his involvement, Ed served in various capacities locally and eventually became the commander of Post 49 in Cedar Falls, Iowa. He went on to serve in a variety of AMVETS roles in the state of Iowa, including state commander. People recognized his talent and leadership abilities, and he soon took on national AMVET duties, one of which was with their National Finance Office. As he continued his service, he was elected in 2005 as National Commander of the AMVETS and was sworn in at a ceremony in Kansas City. From there, he toured various states, along with several foreign countries, representing the United States AMVETS. In 1991, he married Nancy Jewell, and together they continued to be active in AMVET events. Ed is survived by his children, Tess Lee, Scott Kemp, Debbie Cox, and Brian Kemp, all of Louisiana, along with his stepchildren, Renee Trenton of Rudd, Iowa, Natalie Cummings of Cedar Falls, and Brent Hoff of Waterloo. In addition, he is survived by his brother Pete of Waterloo, sister Mary Jo Hartley of Oswego, Kathy Cocorin of Hazeltown, Pat Kaiser of Independence, Roberta Mason of Independence, Annette Kemp of Waterloo, and sister-in-law Leanne Kemp of Waterloo, along with 14 grandchildren and 7 great-grandchildren, and numerous nieces and nephews. He is preceded in death by his parents, wife, Nancy, sister Carol and Liz, brother Mike, stepson Perry Hoff, brothers-in-law Tom Kyer, Claire Lewandowski, and Don King. Ed is interred at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery in Van Meter, Iowa. The celebration of life on September 5th will be directed by the officers of the Cedar Falls AMVETS located at 1934 Irving Street. Full military honors will be conducted at 2 o'clock with a reception to follow. Memorial and donations may be made to Sullivan Harto Davis Cedar Falls Honor Flights. P.O. Box is 182 Cedar Falls, Iowa 50613, or the Cedar Falls AMVET Post 49. Leon Arthur Skibunya. Leon Arthur Skibunya of Cedar Falls died at home on August 25th, 2021 of natural causes. He was born July 22nd, 1927 in Olwine, the son of Otto and Mabel Skibunya. Leon graduated from Olwine High School in 1945, then worked for the Chicago Great Western Railroad and Raytheon Corporation in Olwine. On July 3, 1949, he married Miss Helen L. Gatto of Maynard. Most of Leon's career, he worked for the Universal Hoist Industries of Cedar Falls, partially retiring in August 1991 as an executive manager and VP. Leon is survived by his son, Dr. Martin L. Skubina of Washington, D.C., and daughter Robin A. Albert of Glenwood. Three grandchildren, Rebecca Albert Erie, Brooke Parker, Luke Albert, six great-grandchildren, Mara and Lane Parker, Nora Violet and Askell Albert, and Maverick Lee Volrath, a nephew, Neil W. Skubina of Swansboro, as well as numerous cousins in California, Minnesota, North Dakota, Oregon, Washington State, and across the nation. He was preceded in death by his beloved wife, two parents, and two brothers, Delbert and Edwin Skubina. Leon's funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Wednesday, September 1st, 2021, in the Larson Chapel at Nazareth Lutheran Church in Cedar Falls, with half an hour of visitation prior. Burial will follow at Greenwood Cemetery in Cedar Falls. Leon's hobbies include collecting antique cars and fishing, as well as reading and watching westerns. He also enjoyed traveling across the United States, as well as visiting relatives and former business associates in Munich, Germany. Leon Skubina was known as a man of high integrity and honesty to his many friends and family. Marilyn Ackerman. Marilyn Ackerman, 72, of Waterloo, died Tuesday, August 24, 2021. She was born January 24, 1949, in Des Moines, the daughter of Lawrence P. Agnes A. Jensen. Marilyn served in the United States Army during Vietnam from 1967 to 1970, receiving an honorable discharge. She married Robert L. Ackerman in May of 1975. He died October 29, 1997. Marilyn had worked for the Waterloo Center for the Arts for 39 years, retiring in 2010. She is survived by two sisters, Jobeth Hammer of Des Moines and Margaret DeLeon of Kansas City, and several nieces and nephews. Marilyn is preceded into death by her parents and husband. Family services will be held at a later date at Mount Olivet Cemetery. Condolences may be left at www.lockfuneralhome.com. Dorothea Weinberg. Dorothea F. Weinberg, beloved aunt and wife, died peacefully on August 26th after a month-long battle with cancer. She is preceded in death by her husband, David Weinberg, sisters Pauline Lam and Sylvia Williams, and brother Albert and Edwin Lipschutz. Dorothea was born on March 22, 1923, in Canton, Ohio. She was the second youngest of five children born to Nathan and Regina Lipschutz. After graduating from McKinley High School, she completed a course in cosmetology and embarked on a very successful career as a beautician. In 1957, she met David Weinberg, who was to become part of her life partner for 49 wonderful years. They were married in Cleveland in 1956 and remained in Canton for another decade. David was imbued with an entrepreneurial spirit, and in 1968, the couple began a new chapter in their lives in Las Vegas as franchise of Hickory Farms. From Las Vegas, their franchising journey took them to South Bend, Indiana, Corona Del Mar, California, and finally to the beautiful college town of Cedar Falls, Iowa. The two of them worked side by side in the local caramel corn franchise at College Square until David decided it was time to retire and sell the business. They loved everything about Cedar Falls and had established roots, so they looked no further for a retirement destination. Their retirement was full of exotic cruises, day trips with the local senior organizations, and volunteer work. Sturgis Falls Days was a particular favorite of theirs. They made donuts, sold t-shirts, and thoroughly enjoyed the music and festivities. When David was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 1999, their happy retirement changed. David was admitted to Windsor Skilled Nursing Facility after breaking a leg in 2001 and would spend the next 7 years there. Even though she didn't drive, Dorothea managed to get to the nursing home every day, spending hours there, helping to care for him until his death in 2008. Dorothea kept busy during the next several years with activities at Cedar Falls Senior Center and Cedar Falls Women's Club, and her beloved Sturgis Falls Days. She even had a part-time job doing product demonstrations at local grocery stores. In 2013, she moved into Windhaven Assisted Living at the Western Home and made many friends there during the 8 years that she resided there. Dorothea is survived by her nieces, Regina Silbert, Cindy Lipschutz, of Jacksonville, Florida, Risa Einhorn, nephew John Lipschutz of Raleigh, North Carolina, and numerous great nieces and nephews and cousins. Special thanks goes to the wonderful staff at Windhaven Assisted Living, Cedar Valley Hospice, and her dear friends, Christy and Kim Kusteling and Judith Finkelstein. Graveside services will be at 1 p.m. today, August 29th, at the Beth Olm section of Waterloo Memorial Park Cemetery with burial there. There will be no visitation. Haggerty Weitchoff Group Funeral Service on West Ridgeway is in charge of arrangements. Memorials may be directed to the Cedar Valley Hospice or the Western Home Communities Foundation. Now, let's move over to some sports articles, starting with UNI's Colavier makes big impact at linebacker. Ask Jeremiah Johnson about Spencer Colavier and his eyes light up. The veteran Northern Iowa defensive coordinator is a huge fan of his all-conference linebacker. Spencer is a very sharp kid who has done a great job for us, Johnson said. He plays hard and is very coachable. He's a really good kid. And he's got a great head of hair. Yes, the hair. The long flowing locks that Colavier possesses really are quite impressive. I haven't cut my hair since freshman year, so I've been growing it out for the last couple of years, Colavier said with a smile. Bryce Flatter has grown out his hair too, and we look like WWE pro wrestlers. We're a linebacker duo with a good head of lettuce, and it's something we just have fun with. The 6'3", 245-pounder from Cresco looks like he could model for GQ magazine with his long hair and chiseled physique. He's also a heck of a football player. Colavier can't wait to return to the football field when UNI opens its season this Saturday at Iowa State. I'm about as excited as I could be. I'm ready to go, he said prior to a recent practice at the UNI Dome. It's going to be a nice play in front of 60,000 fans. We haven't played in front of a large crowd in a while. It's going to be fun. Colavier earned first-team All-State honors in football for Crestwood High School before enrolling at Iowa Central Community College. He suffered a torn ACL in his knee during his first game at Iowa Central and received a medical redshirt. Colavier came back strong the following season in 2018. He earned all-conference honors for the Tritons, and after recording 96 total tackles, including 22 for losses, he joined the UNI program the next season and made an immediate impact. He ranked third on the team with 88 tackles. Colavier followed a superb campaign this past spring, earning first-team all-conference honors after averaging 10 tackles per game for the Panthers. He also is an excellent student and made the conference all-academic team. Colavier's first game in Northern Iowa uniform came 2 years ago at Iowa State. The Panthers fell in triple overtime. It was such a long game, Colavier said. I remember it being exhausting by the time it was done. And I remember it being surreal for me. I went from a junior in college and playing in front of maybe 1,000 fans to playing in front of 60,000 fans at Iowa State. It was a massive jump between two levels of football. Northern Iowa's Week 1 opponent has received plenty of preseason hype, and deservedly so, after returning most of its players from last year's nine-win season. The Cyclones were ranked number 7 nationally in the presentation, and Colavier and his teammates know it will be a tough test for UNI. Playing Iowa State, it's definitely going to be a great challenge for us, Colavier said. They have a very good team. We have good players and a preseason All-Americans on our team, too. It'll be great to compete against a high-level team like that. Colavier is one of the greatest leaders on a strong UNI defense that allows just 15 points per game during the abbreviated 7-game spring season. We have a lot of great players on defense, and we have great coaching, he said. Our coaches do a heck of a job with each position, and they come up with great scheme each week. They make it easy for us to learn and helps us play better. Colavier benefits greatly from playing directly behind All-American defensive tackle Jared Brinkman, the reigning Missouri Valley Football Conference Defensive Player of the Year. Jared makes things go, Colavier said. He takes on double teams and the triple teams, and if he doesn't get double teamed, he's making the tackle. It's very nice to be able to sit behind a guy who is going to take up those blockers. That allows us to be free and find the football. The 23-year-old Colavier actually has had this season and next season left before he completes his college eligibility. The NCAA granted athletes an additional season because of COVID's widespread impact. I'm planning on playing both seasons, Colavier said with a smile. For now, I'm just ready to get this season started. This team can go as far as we want to go. It's going to be up to us as far as the amount of work we put in. If we just keep battling, I think we'll be sitting where we want to be. Now on to another football article. Iowa's Kelly Martin has worked his way back. As his teammates worked on refining skills and growing their games last spring, Ivory Kelly Martin remained focused on a different objective. He simply wanted to be healthy enough to play this fall for the Iowa football team. The fifth-year senior running back, is a starter in the Hawkeye backfield in the 2018 season opener, who has dealt with multiple injury issues, has met that goal. Recovered from an anterior cruciate ligament tear that had sidelined him during the delayed 2020 season, Kelly Martin is listed as the backup to Tyler Goodson for Saturday's 2:30 p.m. season opener against Indiana at Kinnick Stadium. And now, he's prepared to make the most of his senior season in an Iowa uniform. It feels good to be back on the field again, doing the things that I know I can do to help the team, said Kelly Martin, whose resume includes a 752-yard of total offense, a blend of his rushing and pass-catching abilities. Kelly Martin has been helping the Hawkeyes since 2017, following an all-state career as a running back at Oswego East in the western suburbs of Chicago. He became the only true freshman in the past decade to rush a pair of touchdowns in a game where he ran for a pair against North Texas in 2017. A year later, he started in the backfield of Iowa's season opener against Northern Illinois, but was sidelined for four games that season by injury. He saw action in four games in 2019 before returning in a reserve role in 2020, carrying 15 times for 54 yards in seven games, before missing what played out as the season finale against Wisconsin because of an ACL injury. It's been difficult at times. Things certainly haven't followed the script that I would have written heading into it all. But everything happens for a reason, Kelly Martin said. I've tried to do the best for the team in whatever situation I found myself in. That role has evolved over time, growing into a more vocal leader on the team with each passing year. Kelly Martin has tried to use his experiences to help teammates on and off the field. There have been times when I've had to concentrate on helping guys while I was out, doing what I can do to prepare them to play and doing everything I can to make sure they're ready to go at a time when I couldn't, Kelly Martin said. That's what teammates are supposed to do, be there for each other, and I've tried to be there for the other guys, just like other guys have been there for me. And now Kelly Martin's role includes being ready himself for a return to the field. I feel like I'm capable of doing everything I've always done, and I'm looking forward to do those things when I get the chance, Kelly Martin said. My job now is to be ready to go. Iowa coach Kirk Fertinez is counting on that. He welcomes the return of a reliable, healthy running back with the ability to complement the abilities of Goodson, an all-Big Ten selection a year ago when he led the Hawkeyes in rushing in each of the two seasons in an Iowa jersey. Ivory is a veteran player who clearly knows how to operate and just how to do things, Fertness said. He's been a really good leader on our football team. He does it in a very quiet way, but he is really good with our entire football team. Fertinez expects Kelly Martin to be in a position to play a role similar to the one McKee Sargent filled last season while rushing 432 yards on 76 carries in 8 games. Much like Sargent, Fertinez considers Kelly Martin to be a second starter at the position. It's a luxury because we do look at him as a starter. Having him and Tyler out there gives you two guys who are really experienced, and they're both tremendous guys and tremendous players, Fertinez said. There's only one position where feel like we have a good pool of players. Coming off his latest injury, Iowa has been cautious in how Kelly Martin has been utilized during the Hawkeyes Kids Day scrimmage earlier this month. He caught a touchdown pass and displayed some elusiveness, which put him in a starting role 3 seasons ago. It was a type of effort that Fertinez said has been commonplace during the Hawkeyes preseason camps. He's back healthy, and it's been a long journey back, and even in the summertime, he's had some soreness every now and then, but that's to be expected when you're trying to come back and you're pushing hard to make that happen, Fertinez said. Kelly Martin wants to make that happen. It's been good for me to get back on the field, Kelly Martin said. When you're on the side, you do what you can do to help, but there's nothing better than being out there. It's tough when you can't be involved in team activities. It tugs at you a bit. With the injuries he has dealt with, Kelly Martin has gained an understanding of how to deal with it all and has welcomed his return to full work in the practice field step by step. He said the support of teammates, coaches, and athletic training and strength conditioning staff helped him as he worked his way back. "It's a process dealing with it all, but you can work through it," Kelly Martin said. "It's that first time putting your foot on the ground and trying to make a cut. There's a little hesitancy, but then you can make that cut and it's all good. Then it's just football and you can go play." That's all Kelly Martin really wants, that chance to play. "Time goes by so quickly. When you get the chance to be out there, cherish it. Make the most of every snap," Kelly Martin said. "That's how I look at it now. Make the most of every moment." Let's end today with the article, "Mike Rose Leads Deep and Talented Linebacker Group at Iowa State." Iowa State might not have a more ready-to-go position than linebacker. The Cyclones have, at minimum, an all-Big 12 starting linebacker at all three linebacker spots. They have a proven backup at all three positions, too. The group is led by All-American and Big 12 Defensive Player of the Year, Mike Rose. Rose led the nation in interceptions by a linebacker last season with 5. And it should be mentioned that his pass coverage ability isn't usually the first thing that gets brought up with Rose. He's a do-everything linebacker that plays well in space and excels at making one-on-one tackles. He led the Big 12 in tackles with 96 tackles. He also had 10.5 tackles for a loss and 6 QB hurries. Coach Matt Campbell has been effusive in his praise of Rose throughout the years. Those feelings have waned. What you really appreciate about Mike is when the team needed him most, he always came up with a play, Campbell said. He was always there for the stop or made that play. He was always where he needed to be and when he needed to be there. I think about what Mike does to maximize his full potential in terms of work ethic, attitude, effort, how he practices. I love Mike because he's the same guy no matter what day of the week it is. If you came to a Tuesday or a Wednesday practice, it's the same guy you see on Saturday. I've always felt that the great players and the elite players that I've coached have that same unique trait. Rose has been a near elite linebacker since he stepped out on the field as a true freshman against Iowa and recorded 11 tackles. Since then, he's only gotten better even though teams have started to game plan for him. Mike understands that it's not going to be any easier for him, Campbell said. Teams are going to try and formation against him or go away from him. They are going to be unique challenges that come his way. The better he gets, the more teams will plan for him. That challenge will challenge him to be his best. Mike has taken that challenge. What he looks like right now compared to what he looked like last year is day and night. That is a total credit to Mike Rose. It's all about how do you take another step forward with him. I'm really proud of what he has done to prepare for this fall. Rose's running mates are middle linebacker Orion Vince and outside linebacker Jake Hummel. What Orion Vance has done, and you can't talk about Orion without talking about Jake Hummel because those two are outstanding, Campbell said. Mike gets a lot of credit, but when you really sit back and study the videotapes, the consistency that those two have played with is nothing short of exceptional. Hummel was second on the team last year with 77 tackles, and Vance was third with 68 tackles. 2 seasons ago, when Jaquan Bailey was injured, Vance was leading the Big 12 in sacks until he suffered an injury of his own. Backing the trio is another younger trio. Garen Vaughn, Eric Horn, and Deshaun Davis all saw significant time last season as special teamers and key reserves, planning in every game. That proven depth, coupled with the sheer quality of the starters, has the position group rated at the second best in the nation by Phil Steele. They can all drop into coverage, and they can all run sideline into sideline, and they can all apply pressure, Campbell said. They all have a lot of experience that has allowed them to raise themselves physically and mentally. And we'll actually finish off with one more short article. Himes takes 5th in Tokyo. Northern Iowa alum Jessica Himes took 5th in the F64x44 discus classification in the 2020 Paralympic Games Saturday. Himes, a native of Swisher twice broke the North American record during the competition with a best throw of 34.89 meters on her fifth attempt. She broke the record with a throw of 34.42 with her second toss. This was the second time that the recent graduate had participated in the Paralympic Games. She was eighth as a 17-year-old in Rio de Janeiro in 2016. Himes, who is a F-64 thrower, finished behind four F-44 classification throwers. Yuan Yao of China won with a toss of 44.73 meters. Yu Yang of China earned silver, and Sarah Eastman of Australia won the bronze medalist. Ida Nessie of Norway was fourth. UNI teammate Aaron Kirchhoff competes Tuesday at the T13 100 and then again on September 2nd in the T13 400. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo and Cedar Falls Courier for Sunday, August 29th. I'm your reader, Will Potter. You can access a recording of today's reading at our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.